Welcome to See Hear Speak podcast, episode 51. In this episode, I am joined by co-host Kate Radville. We talk with Danica Pfeiffer about interprofessional practice, collaborative school-based partnerships, and the importance of qualitative research. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out the website, www.seehearspeakpodcast.com, to sign up for email alerts for new episodes and content, read a transcript of this podcast, access articles and resources that we discussed, and find more information about our guests. Welcome to episode 51 of See, Hear, Speak podcast. Today, I have a co-host with me. And as you know, I'm Tiffany Hogan, the main host, and I will have this co-host introduce herself.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thank you, Tiffany. My name is Kate Radville. I am currently a doctoral student working with Tiffany in the SAIL Literacy Lab. I am also an educator, including a former classroom teacher, a speech-language pathologist, and a literacy specialist by training. My research interests are in dyslexia and developmental language disorder, including parent advocacy and best practices for literacy instruction for children with dyslexia and in general education. I'm going to turn it over to our wonderful guest. It's my pleasure to introduce Danica Pfeiffer, who I've recently had the opportunity to collaborate with on projects with our lab.
Thank you both so much for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation today. My name is Danica Pfeiffer. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Speech-Language Pathology and Audiology at Towson University. And my primary research interest is in enhancing children's early language and literacy skills through building collaborative school-based partnerships. And I also am a host of a podcast about From and With, which shares SLP stories and stories of other professionals that we work closely with.
Great. I'm so happy to have you here, Danica. It's been great to start working with you on lots of projects, especially around qualitative research and implementation science. So it's great to have you here. Much of your work, as you said, has focused on improving children's early language and literacy skills through collaborative school-based partnerships. Can you start by telling us a bit about some of those partnerships? What do they look like, and why do you find them to be so important for improving children's early language and literacy?
Sure. So I really started becoming passionate about building partnerships when I myself was an SLP in the schools. So I started off in my clinical fellowship in a preschool as a preschool SLP, which is my passion. And I had had some really great interprofessional training. I was really fortunate in my grad program. And I couldn't wait to collaborate with others when I got out into the schools. And then when I got there, I saw that there was not a lot of collaboration happening. And I started to even doubt my own ability to collaborate with others, because even though I felt prepared going into working in the schools, once I got there, I realized it was a lot harder than it looks. And I think a lot of people assume that they're good collaborators. We are speech language pathologists. We're good communicators. But when it comes to communicating and collaborating with professionals from other disciplines, I found it to be so challenging. And that was with training. But I know that a lot of SLPs do not have this training. We know only about 40% of SLPs have training on how to collaborate with others. And so we have a long way to go in this area. And so for me, I saw this need, and I was working on my dissertation at the same time that I was doing my clinical fellowship. And I said, this is what I want to do. This is the area that I need to research, because we need to learn more about how to do this more effectively. And I really felt like I was almost doing a disservice to the kids that I was working with and that I was serving on my caseload, because I wasn't collaborating as much as I could have, and I wasn't as confident as I should have been in being able to share information effectively with the other professionals and the families that I was working with. So for me, I'm really passionate now about how can we build training for SLPs and other school-based professionals so that we can teach them how to collaborate effectively, communicate effectively with one another. And I also see it as a way that we can share responsibility for the children that are on our caseload and providing them with the best quality services that they really deserve. And in the schools, that's an area that's very overwhelming. We know that SLPs have very high caseloads. They're taking on a lot, and they are trying their very best to do the best for the families that they serve. But they feel this great burden that there's so many of them and that they have so much to do in each day, each week in the schools. But I feel like building these collaborative partnerships could be one way that we could take away some of that weight. We can share that weight with others. And we know that burnout is something that's huge in the schools. But for me, this is something that we could potentially strengthen so that there's less of that burnout at the end of the day and that SLPs are more excited to go to work and collaborate and learn new things from other professionals in the school to help them do their jobs better. So ultimately, I think these partnerships can benefit not only the kids that we work with, but also the professionals themselves.
That makes total sense. And I'm wondering for our listeners here, could you tell us the definition or what you think of when what are you thinking about when you say interprofessional collaboration? And can you paint a picture for us of what it looks like for the SLP, the child, and the family, if there is strong interprofessional collaboration versus paint the picture of a situation where there's not strong interprofessional collaboration? Because I'm thinking if we paint these two pictures, it'll really highlight for our listeners the benefits that you've seen and that we've seen in the profession to have these collaborations.
Yes. So interprofessional practice has changed names. I think it's important to know that. There's so many terms out there for interprofessional practice. We have called it interprofessional collaboration. We have called it collaboration. We've used other collaboration models interchangeably that are really different than interprofessional practice. So we've used terms like interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary. These are all their own unique service delivery collaboration models. And so I think that's important to know because we talk about them interchangeably, but they have their own definitions. So when we talk about a multidisciplinary team, this is very different than an interprofessional team. A multidisciplinary team is where we're going to have professionals that are from different disciplines working with the same child and family, and they're all seeing the child and family very separately from one another. They do their own assessments, they come up with their own treatment plan. Often there's very little communication in between the professionals. They don't communicate regularly. They're all kind of in their own lane working with the family. Interdisciplinary is another collaboration model that's a very unique model from interprofessional. It's a little more collaborative. Here we have different professionals from different disciplines working with the same family and child. Here they're going to do their own evaluation separately, but they're going to now share information with one another about the things that they're seeing. So they'll share information about the background and history, about what happened in the evaluation, about the family's priorities and goals. They're still going to do treatment sessions individually, but they do have some shared information, and they're also including the family as part of the conversation more regularly when they're making decisions. And then we have interprofessional, which is the most collaborative. In the literature, you also might see transdisciplinary as another term for interprofessional. This is the most collaborative collaboration model that we know of, that we have. And this is the one that Asha is really passionate about. Asha really wants us to enhance our interprofessional education that we provide for graduate students and also for our in-service SLPs that are working in the field. In this model, we have professionals that are from different disciplines coming together with working with the same family and child, but now they're providing really comprehensive and integrated services. So what you might see in this model is what we call an arena evaluation, where all of the professionals come together and they assess the child at once. So they're all in the room all at the same time. And this makes a lot of sense, right? Because we're all collecting a case history. We're all looking for similar types of information. And typically the families are going to go from place to place, center to center, and get asked the same questions over and over again. But during an ARENA evaluation, everyone comes together at the same time. They can listen to one another's questions. They can build off of others' questions during that initial evaluation. Then they come together and they create a shared treatment plan. So everyone contributes to the treatment plan and the family is part of that process. So their goals and their priorities are really at the center of that treatment plan. Then all of the professionals take responsibility for all of the goals on the treatment plan. So it's no longer the OT only does fine motor, speech only does speech and language. No, everyone is responsible for all of the goals. There's going to be regular communication between all of the professionals where they're sharing information about what they're seeing with the child, what they're seeing with the family. And then in treatment, what this might look like is that there will be multiple professionals coming together to work with the child at once. So we might see an OT and PT pair up, an SLP and an OT pair up together, and they provide services together with one another. We also might see this in a school setting as co-teaching, where we have a general ed teacher partnering with an SLP, for example, or a special education teacher working with an SLP. And so this can be done together at the same time. I think there's a misconception that it always has to be together at the same time. You can also be on an interprofessional team and not be delivering services together at the same time, but you're regularly sharing information about what you're seeing with the child, and you are coordinating your efforts to all be working towards the same goals. So that's really the important piece, is that it's no longer a siloed treatment plan, but we are all working towards the same goals to really support the child as a whole.
This resonates with me so much. So I just wanted to say, you know, your description of working as the clinician and seeing how hard this is on the ground, even with training, I can relate so much. So I started my career as an educator. So I was a, you know, gen ed classroom teacher, and I had no training in collaboration. And sort of for different reasons, I felt very lost. You know, when do I even refer a child to a speech pathologist? What does a speech pathologist do? Which seems wild now, right? Having been one for over a decade. So I've seen this, how hard this is sort of on the ground. It really is. So what needs to be in place for this to work? What do SLPs need to make this happen?
So what we really need is training, and this should start in our graduate program or even undergrad. I will say there's a little bit of a debate there about when is the right time to start providing interprofessional education. Some people think that starting at the undergraduate level is too early because students don't have enough of their professional identity quite yet. So when they come together to collaborate on case studies, for example, they don't know enough about what their role is going to be as a professional to be able to effectively collaborate and share that information with others. And so that it can almost have an opposite effect, where they feel less confident when they leave that scenario or that experience because they don't know enough about their own role yet. Others really want this interprofessional education to start at the undergraduate level. I would put myself in that camp, because if they start out their undergraduate career in knowing that collaboration is expected, if you want to go into this profession, it is expected that you collaborate with others and that you know others' roles that you're going to be working with in a school or in a hospital, wherever you are going to work, then I think just from day one, knowing that when you're starting out as an undergrad will change the way that you provide services in the future. So for me, I really hope that we can start building this not only into our graduate training, but also undergraduate level. So ASHA now has included interprofessional education in the graduate accreditation standards for speech and audiology, which is great. And so more and more programs are starting to think really strategically about how we can provide this training. But now programs are doing this however they want to, which it's great that it's happening, but it looks very different depending on what graduate program you're in. So what it could look like is you might have a single day interprofessional case study where you come together with healthcare professions from around your college and you engage in a case study where you meet other students from other programs, you learn about their roles, and you work together on a case where you can all contribute. That's great. Then you leave, and now you're trained in interprofessional education. So not that it's not effective, but it's very brief. And what we see from those experiences is overwhelmingly positive opinions from students that these are effective, these are helpful. Students feel more positive about collaboration when they leave these experiences. They have more positive attitudes about collaboration, and they learn more. They have greater knowledge about interprofessional practice. What we see as being more effective than just those single case experiences or single day experiences is where we build on that foundational knowledge and we actually let students try it out, where they actually go and collaborate on teams with one another and work with patients in a very safe setting. This could be in a simulation that's done online, a simulation in a simulation lab, or it could be in a clinic where it's a student clinic and they work with patients that come in from the community. And we know that those experiences really magnify the effects for students. They feel much more confident in their interprofessional ability if they have that hands-on practice when they are in their training program. For those that go on to work in the schools, we know that SLPs who have co-teaching experience while they're in their graduate program are 6 times more likely to go and collaborate with teachers when they're out in the field. So this has a huge potential impact. And so I think it's great now that we are thinking about this more strategically, but we should also think about how this interprofessional education is provided to try to build in more time for practice.
You know, I will say that my experience as, you know, as a student and also as a professor has been the case where it's been more like, hey, let's have a class on interprofessional or let's talk about it, you know, touch on it in each course. But then I have to give a big shout out to the Institute of Education, or where I am now, Institute of Health Professions, the Communication Sciences and Disorders, because when I came 10 years ago, they were already working towards a model that I was just blown away by. And that is that from day one in the graduate program, you're set up with these IPE or interprofessional education groups. And they're, you know, set up with OT, PT, and actually other professionals as well, PA, nursing. And they're put in these groups together and they work with the same group over 2 years learning as you go, and they have lots of different opportunities. I, as a parent, participated in something called Baby Day, which was super fun, where you have arena assessments on children under 3. And as a parent, I got to go and just, you know, talk about my baby, which was amazing. But I also, I love that they're really getting that interprofessional education. I also worked as a speech pathologist in a hospital for some time, and we did arena assessments, and this was, you know, I'll date myself, in, you know, mid 90s. So it's been going on for a while. But my question is about, and I've thought a bit about this, is this idea that you have the hospital-based interprofessional educate or practice. And that's what I see more at my institute, is this model of more of the medical-based. And when I was working as a clinician in the hospital, I felt like the system was set up for interprofessional you know, collaboration more than my experience working in schools. So I know you did a survey around, you know, SLP's engagement in a professional collaborative practice in schools. And I'm wanting you to talk about what you found in that survey. And also, do you see, like I do, this difference between what's happening in the hospital and the schools? What, if you do, what are you seeing driving those differences? What can we learn from what's being done in medical? How can we do better from what's been being done in the medical field related to your paper?
Sure. So I will say you're completely right. There are 2 different ways to be successful in collaborating. In the healthcare setting is one way, and then in schools, completely different. There's different laws in place. There's different guidance in place on how you work in each of these settings that dictate that. With interprofessional education, there are 4 core competencies, though, and these 4 competencies can span how we train SLPs across settings. So we know that if we provide information and education in these 4 areas, then they can take those competencies and apply them in either setting. And so this, these 4 competencies came from the Interprofessional Education Collaborative as a way to build a common language across disciplines And so these are teams and teamwork, roles and responsibilities, interprofessional communication, and values and ethics. And so if we provide this education for our students, we know that then they can take that information and apply it in either setting. However, we also know that they need that setting-specific training to be able to be effective when they go out and actually try to apply these competencies to their workplace. So for this survey that we did, we surveyed SLPs across the country that were working in schools to find out what kind of collaboration they were engaging in, which of those collaboration models that I talked about earlier. We wanted to know, especially specific to the IEP process of evaluation and treatment, what kind of collaboration are they engaged in right now? And this was happening right as I was doing my CF. So I was saying, you know, I'm not seeing it here in my school, but maybe it's just my school. Maybe the, you know, other states are doing this more. Maybe other places have a lot of interprofessional practice happening. So that's what I really wanted to find out. Because we knew that these terms, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, and interprofessional, are often used interchangeably, and a lot of people don't know the differences between them, which how would you if you weren't studying it in a research study? We decided not to use the terms on the survey, but we created a series of vignettes where we asked them specific questions about scenarios that they encounter in their everyday practice as part of the IEP process. And we asked them to select which answer was most reflective of how they typically work in the school. And then on the back end, we coded them as either multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, or interprofessional. And by doing that, we were able to find out what kinds of collaboration they're using the most. We saw that interprofessional practice was not happening very much. So we asked them about a variety of scenarios, and the one time that they were collaborating the most on interprofessional teams was during IEP eligibility meetings. This makes a lot of sense because everyone's together around the same table. We're all sharing information with one another. But even then, we saw that only 43% of SLPs said that they were using an interprofessional model during that time. So even though they're all there together, that means that maybe they're not including the family as much in that conversation. Maybe everybody's coming to the table with their goals already written and they're not asking for input. They just lay them out. Here are the goals, and they're not getting feedback from others. We saw when we looked at evaluations, how often is interprofessional practice happening there? Only 8% of SLPs said that they're doing those arena assessments or working with others during the evaluation process. And then during intervention, only 14%. So really we're seeing a lot of SLPs working in their silos by themselves during treatment sessions. So those were some of the big findings that we saw. Another thing that we saw was that when we looked across different levels, different kinds of schools, we saw that elementary school SLPs were more likely to use an interprofessional practice model than SLPs working in secondary schools. We also saw that SLPs who had more years of experience were more likely to use an interprofessional practice model. They've had more time in the schools to develop those relationships with others. And then another big thing was that those who had team-based training, so they had that interprofessional education, they were more likely to engage in interprofessional practice in the school. At the very end of the survey, I asked them, if additional training were offered on how to collaborate on interprofessional teams, would you want to participate? And 99% of our almost 500 respondents said yes. They definitely want to participate. They want this training. And when I asked them what they wanted the training on specifically, which of those core competencies, they said roles and responsibilities. They just want to learn about what the other people in the school do. And that seems so simple to me that we can definitely build this into our training programs. But now we have so many SLPs that are out in the schools and they don't know the roles and responsibilities of others in their school building. So I think that's definitely an easy place to start. You know, it feels like low-hanging fruit that we can definitely tackle that, but now it's just figuring out the best way to do it.
You sort of got to my question. I'm sitting here thinking, you know, so what do we do? And, you know, SLPs are busy and their caseloads can be so large. What can schools do? You know, administrators, leadership, what what can happen to support this, given that we know that many SLPs are already working and haven't had this training, but it sounds like that is a striking statistic. They want,
they want
this education, they want this knowledge. I get that. I wanted it when I was a clinician.
Yes.
So what do we do? What can we do?
Yes. So we did ask them about those barriers of what's getting in the way. And they said time constraints and just scheduling was a huge barrier, as well as resistance from other professionals that they work with. So those other educators in the school, and a lack of support from their employer, their administration. So what do we do about that? How can we help them overcome these things? Well, for time constraints and scheduling, I think this does really need to come from the top. So it needs to come from their administration. And whenever I present on interprofessional practice and I talk with clinicians about this, they ask the same question. Well, what can we do? Like, we want to collaborate together, but our administrators aren't supportive or they don't understand it. And so what I always suggest is that they just start with one person in their school, one person that they want to collaborate with. For me, that was my occupational therapist, who also worked with preschoolers. And we picked one day of the week on Fridays where we came together. I went down to her room and we did therapy together with a small group of preschoolers. And we did that every week. And it was the best part of my job. Like, I loved that Friday morning time block because we could work together. I learned so much from her. It was just such a great experience. And so if you can find that one person and you have some success, share it with your administrators. Share the success that you've had. Show some data. This is what the child's able to do now. We also were able to go to IEP meetings, and I was able to talk about fine motor progress, and my colleague was able to talk about language growth. And that's something that neither one of us would have been able to do before we started working together. And that stood out because administrators are in your IEP meetings. And so this is new, this is different. And you're able to talk together as a team. So I always also encourage, whenever you are advocating for it in your school, you go together, you talk in we language. We think that this is really effective. We have seen changes. We have seen growth. Here is our data. So instead of just coming at it as an I, come as a we and talk about your success together. I think these are things that are small that we can start with. In the meantime, for administrators that really want to be supportive of collaboration, starting with that scheduling and the time constraints, addressing that. So how can we adjust the schedule so that the SLP can be available for our grade level meetings? How can we adjust the schedule so that the SLP has time for shared planning with teachers? So thinking strategically about making small changes just so that they have time that they can collaborate with one another, plan with one another, I think is something that seems overwhelming. It is daunting to do that. But if administrators want to be supportive of this, then we need time. We need it to be a priority. We need support for that. And so thinking strategically about how to build in that planning time, I think is one thing that could really go a long way.
You know, I'm hearing this and I'm thinking about all the different ripple effects you could have from this, you know, setting up a systemic change to include time and a focus of attention showing importance around this practice. And one is, you know, we know, and you touched on it earlier, that speech language pathologists have very high caseloads, are really feeling the pressure. And I, even working, you know, towards literacy outcomes, that's the number one thing I hear is I don't have time to do this. But it does seem like this is one way that we can, you know, maximize the time we have. And also, you did touch on this, the burnout factor, mm-hmm. and how it was your favorite time. But we also know with burnout, social connections,
yes,
are huge. And so we can feel really burnout, you know, running around with our large caseload, but even just that little bit of time, and especially if it was in the system and it was built into our time to make those connections. I mean, what a big impact, not only on the practice, but as a speech pathologist, the feeling of connectivity and shared responsibility. So from the speech pathologist view, and then I'm just thinking too about how we want to make impact and change, and that dosage matters. It's so important. So you know, like you said, you're working with the OT and now they may be working on some language goals because they're seeing it, they're aware of it. That's more dosage. And we know the dosage we give these children with language difficulties is way low that compared yes. to what it really needs to be. So what a impact in terms of our treatment, potential impact on our treatment outcomes. And then as a parent, just knowing that your child's in a system in which they're seen as a whole child. Cause that, mm-hmm. you know, we do a lot of talk about the whole child, but do we really treat the whole child when we're all separated out? And I know as a parent with a child who's on an IEP, it's frustrating when you're talking to the individuals and you have to say the same thing over and over. And you're wondering like, okay, I've got someone supporting him around social skills. And then he goes to another class and that teacher's telling me, well, he's not cooperating in group activities. Well, then I have to explain it. And I've been lucky because that's been a pretty limited experience for me as a parent. I've been very lucky to be in situations where there is a lot of collaboration. So I can, or at least a contact person I can reach out to mm-hmm. and they can work together on the back end. But what a big impact across the board for, you know, reducing burnout, increasing dosage, and really thinking about the whole child. And I really want to just connect with your comment about roles and responsibilities, because I think it actually dovetails really nicely to what I also want to talk to you about in terms of mixed methods and qualitative work. Because you know, as a scientist, I have really been trained more in the quantitative work. Took all the courses I could in statistics when I was a PhD student. The one course I didn't take was qualitative because I, you know, saw myself doing kind of these bigger longitudinal studies, doing randomized control trials. And what I found as a scientist is that I've been drawn to qualitative because it really does help you to better understand your collaborators. So even though it may seem like a leap to make from interprofessional to qualitative, I see it as a pretty straight line, but I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand more about what is the difference between quantitative and qualitative. You know, how did you get to this, you know, qualitative work and mixed methods related to interprofessional, or what just your overall goals?
Yeah. So I'll try to help us make the leap here. This is when it all made sense for me and clicked in my brain, was at the very end of my last dissertation study. So similar to Kate, I also did 3 projects in my dissertation. And the last one was an emergent writing intervention with preschoolers. And I was out in the preschools and we got to the end of the study and I had a meeting with the administrators in the preschool to show them the results. Here's the change, here's the growth in your preschoolers because of this intervention. And one of them looked at me and said, you know, we've really been needing something like this for a long time. Our teachers just don't have a lot of training in writing skills and how to facilitate writing. And I just had this moment where I was like, oh my gosh, I did this completely backwards. I went in there with my mission of I'm gonna do this intervention. I need to find a preschool that'll let me do it. But really this preschool had a need for emergent writing instruction that I didn't know about, I didn't ask about. I just came in with my plan and I carried it out. And great, it was great that both of us needed this and it worked out for us both. But I just had this moment of, oh no, I am approaching research completely the wrong way. I need to start by asking them what their need is and see how we can work together. And so having that realization, that led me to doing a postdoc in implementation science, where I learned more and more about qualitative research and the importance of it. And for me, I see qualitative research as a way for us to learn more from those that we want to work with in the community, those that have a need, where we can use our skills to help them meet their goals as well. And so I love qualitative research because it's a way that I can help others tell their stories. That's really how I think about it when I'm looking at a qualitative project. I'm trying to figure out what is the story here? What are they trying to tell? What am I trying to tell? And that's something I've always been interested in, even as a young child, is stories and storytelling. And so I just love that aspect of qualitative research. I think it's great to inform projects. I think it's also great to assess the impacts of projects that just aren't summarized well with just a number. Maybe that number is part of the story, but there's more there to find out, why was this effective? What parts of it were effective? How did we arrive at that number? And so for me, qualitative research is a great way to be able to do that.
How do you do qualitative research? Can you tell the listeners just a bit about the nuts and bolts, so that I want to talk more about it, but I realize as I'm listening to you that I've learned a lot about it in the last, you know, several years, and I want to make sure the listeners have a good definition and sense of what you do for qualitative.
Yeah. So at the simplest level, qualitative research is doing research with words. So you're collecting words in some format. This could be an open-ended survey question. This could be individual one-on-one interviews, or it could be in focus groups where you're bringing together 6 to 8 people that have a common experience and you are finding out more information about that experience. And so you're collecting a bunch of words, you're putting them into a document, and then you're coming up with a plan of, how do I want to analyze this data? So it could be that you're trying to figure out how a pre-existing theory or perspective maps on to this group of participants that you're working with. So we call that a more deductive method of qualitative analysis, where you have a theory, you have a framework, and you want to see how it fits onto this information that this particular group has shared. Or you might do an inductive analysis, where you have a question that's never been answered before. No one's ever tried to answer it. So you're not really sure what theory fits best. You're not sure what framework fits best. And instead, you look at the words that the participants have shared with you, and you try to categorize them in a way to derive some kind of meaning from them. So now you're going to try to answer your research question by really sticking closely to the words that the participants have shared, and letting that really drive the overarching messages that you are taking from your analysis.
We have a good experience, I think, with Kate's, you know, your first two papers from your dissertation. What do you think, Kate? Would that be a good way to even give an example of kind of how we come about moving from quantitative to qualitative in our case, but also the benefits?
You know, I was just thinking about that, and I was thinking how grateful I feel to have discovered qualitative research, because going in to pursuing this research degree, I really only had quantitative methods in my head, right? I was like, oh, I'm going to take, you know, research design coursework and statistics classes. And I did, I took extra stats and I was like, okay, this is great. It's kind of clean cut in a way. I feel good about this. I actually found qualitative design really challenging to learn about. You know, it felt more nebulous and more uncomfortable, which is, you know, one reason I've been so happy to connect with you, Danica. In my own work, I've seen this already, right? Like, I started out with a first study looking at one really specific aspect of what happened at home for children with DLD during the pandemic. We looked at home literacy and we used quantitative tools, and we did learn about factors associated with home literacy. And we learned that families did more with their child when they were spending more time at home, but that's not the whole picture. And we actually went through this whole thought process. You know, we don't even really know what to ask. We don't know what tool to use. No tools, no quantitative tools seem really fitting. You know, should we use this measure? Should we look at anxiety? Should we look at, you know, time? Like, what do we do? And we ended up asking open-ended questions. And it felt sort of like nebulous and uncomfortable, but it's been eye-opening. And as a result, we have some really interesting information about what was happening at home for kids with DLD when schools were closed, and, you know, there was no tool to measure that. And we did use an inductive approach because we don't have a theory for schools closing during a pandemic when children have language disorder. So I'm really grateful actually that this, it almost felt like happenstance. You know, I'd taken this qualitative design class, then this circumstance came up that was far less than ideal, but it has been just an incredible learning experience.
Yeah, it's a great way if you don't know what to measure. I don't know what I should be looking for. I don't know what their experiences are. just to start with a small group. So you don't need to do a large qualitative study to start to collect some of that information. You could do just a couple small groups where you bring them in for a focus group and you ask some open-ended questions and you see what comes out of it, just to inform a larger study or to inform a study that may be more quantitative. Or that could be part of a mixed method study where you've collected your qualitative data with your open-ended questions, and now you create a survey that's based on the information that you learned from that first step. And now you have a mixed method study. So it's really, it can be a nice way to have a deeper dive into whatever information you're trying to learn.
Qualitative has been so powerful too, for me to think about what, you know, let me try to formulate this in words. At the heart of the research that I do, I wanted to have a clinical impact, and I've always worked with school-based partners, but I've never felt really comfortable being in the role of disseminating what's happening in those settings, not being in that setting right now. I could say, yeah, I've worked in those settings in the past, but things change over time. So I've always felt a bit uncomfortable being the quote-unquote reporter mm-hmm. of what's happening on the ground when I'm not actually on the ground, even if I work intimately with my partners. So qualitative, as for me as a researcher, has made me feel much more comfortable being able to really get the voices of my partners out into the world, and not me as a middle person, almost like interpreting the data to say, oh, this is what I think is happening based on the data. Now, we are always going to do that as scientists, but I feel that qualitative allows me to really say, here's a quote, here's the voice directly from the source about what's happening. And it feels more authentic to that partnership yes. to be able to really listen to and give a microphone to that voice, if that makes any sense. I don't know if that resonates with you, Danica, at all.
It does, yes. And that is actually one piece that we think about a lot in qualitative research is how can we make sure that our analyses are credible? And that process of going back to your participants and saying, here's what I came up with in the analysis process. Here's what I am capturing as the main themes of this conversation that we had together. Going back to them is a process called member checking, and it's an easy thing to do where you approach them with the information that you have come up with in your analysis, and you say, is this right? Does this resonate with you? Am I capturing everything from this conversation? And that's a time where they can say, actually, no, this, you really missed this important piece that I was trying to convey to you. Or yes, absolutely, you've captured everything I was trying to say. I just didn't have the words to say it, you know? And so that process of going through and doing your own analysis as a researcher, but then going back to your participants and getting them to validate your findings is a part of our credibility process, just to make sure that we are accurately representing the messages that our participants are trying to share.
This seems so respectful to the people we work with, right? Like, not only does it increase credibility for our work, which we want to do as researchers, to do our very best, but it really says, I care. Like, I want to give you a voice. Have you found that participants respect that? Are they happy to be sort of asked yes. to continue to participate at that level?
Yes. In my experience, yes. Even if it's months later, because we know qualitative research can be a time-consuming process.
Yes.
Even if it's months later, in my experience, almost every time I have done this, everyone responds. Everyone enjoys wow. being invited to that conversation, getting to read over what you have come up with from your analysis. And a lot of the times they agree, which is great. You know, you feel like, okay, I have done this process well. I have captured what they're trying to say. But then other times there are small tweaks or other things that they want you to include. And then I really enjoy that process because then we have to go back to the data. Okay, how can we capture this? We missed this. And then you put that in your manuscript. We went back to the participants and they thought that this was really important because at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to share their story. So including that process and being transparent about it, I think only it makes it more rigorous. It makes it a more credible process. But then you're also getting that validation that you are doing you're doing your best for these participants. You're sharing their whole story that they're trying to convey.
This is fantastic. I hope that some of our listeners who are scientists will consider seeking out collaborators on qualitative work and really thinking through how qualitative work and mixed methods, so adding qualitative to your quantitative work, will inform your research and really help to amplify the voices of those who we partner with and the children that we serve. So I really appreciate that. Shifting to a slightly different topic, thinking about amplifying voices, you have your own podcast about From and With. Can you tell us what inspired you to start that? You know, what topics does it address and who might be interested in listening? I think this is right in line with amplifying voices.
So there is kind of a theme here. I love qualitative research and the opportunity to share other stories. And I really wanted to do that with the podcast as well. And so About, From, and With came about because interprofessional education and practice are all focused on learning about, from, and with other professionals. And so that's what I wanted to really do, was tie in this interprofessional piece with sharing stories. And so what I hope to do on the podcast, and I try my best to do, is share SLP stories and how they got to where they are. I think a lot of times we hear the success stories of people. We hear all of the wonderful things they're doing, which is great. But as someone new coming into the field, it might be overwhelming of, how did you even get there? My students ask me this all the time. How did you get there? What were the steps you had to take? And so I really try to share that whole story of the highs and the lows with my participants. And I'm grateful for those that are willing to share those things, which we don't always want to share with others. And in the first season of the podcast, I shared stories of SLPs as well as other professionals and how they got to where they are today. I also shared my own PhD journey of the steps that I had to take to get where I am today. And then this season, I have narrowed in on the academic job search process and telling the stories of people that have gone through that process for a variety of positions. So we've talked about non-tenure track positions, tenure track positions, clinical educator positions, and the process that everyone has gone through to be able to secure one of those positions. So I've really tried to make that process more transparent, because going through it myself, there's so much mystery around the academic job search process. And so I've been trying to share that so that people have that information and it's more transparent, no matter what research lab you're coming from or what university you're coming from, to try to make that information more accessible to people.
I just feel so grateful for, you know, you doing that. And again, for everyone who's been willing to share experiences that aren't straightforward, because I know for myself, you know, when people ask me sort of, what do you do? I'm like, oh my gosh, it's been so circuitous. Like, I really haven't progressed in a straight line through a single career. I've been a classroom teacher and a speech pathologist. I've worked in medical settings. I'm like, how does this even all fit together? And it hasn't been the most clear-cut path. Mm-hmm. And it also, you know, it doesn't always seem like the most clear-cut path being a PhD student. There are so many options, and that's a great thing, but it is a little overwhelming. Like, what am I doing when I'm done with this? You know, what is the path forward? It's crucial. It's crucial we have these conversations that aren't just, you know, we often see the outcome and we see people's CVs. And I know I scroll down and I'm like, oh my gosh, you have 4,000 publications. But like, hearing like, no, this didn't just happen overnight, and it wasn't always just a clear-cut path, is just so valuable.
I always find it a bit ironic, because, you know, we study development, and it's easy to come to a mentor. Like, even my students come to me and they think like somehow I was fully formed in this way.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Like, oh, this is how we do. This is how she must have been a researcher from minute one. But it's ironic, because we study development. And I always think to myself, like, my current students are seeing me as a fully formed adult, but my first students saw me as an infant, and they saw the toddler version. And I think that, like, one thing I've regretted over is that I resaved over my CVs. I really wish I would have kept a CV. So if anyone's starting out new and you would like to do this, I highly encourage it, to keep a CV for every year, because I would do anything to have that, you know, because then I could just say, oh, look, now that especially I'm hitting, you know, the 20 years, you know, it's like I could say, you know, this is what it was the first year and second year. It would be a developmental trajectory. And I think we don't have that. And
Tiffany, so I just wrote that down. I put that on my to-do list.
Your future students and collaborators, so thank you.
Okay, done.
Because we don't do that enough. And I think what you're doing is such a great service, Danica, because you are shining a light on development through your stories.
Yes.
And that you know, and development, as we know, has stops and starts. And it's, I always say growing is painful too. I mean, it really is. And you're sharing those, you know, the joys and the pains of growing and growing into who we are now. And I think that your podcast just has such a great handle on that and a great focus. So every listeners, if you're interested, I would highly encourage you to go out and listen to Danica's podcast. It's really quite fantastic.
Thank you so much.
What a great discussion we've had. Of course, I'm mindful of time, like I always am. With our discussions, because I could talk to you for days.
I love it.
And I'm lucky because I get to work with you. But
I'm lucky too.
Let me ask the final questions I always ask listeners. So the first one is, what are you working on now that you're most excited about?
So next week, I have a new study starting, which I'm really excited about. I am continuing my emergent writing work, which I mentioned briefly earlier, and I'm starting a study to examine the early writing skills of children with developmental language disorder. So we know that typically developing children follow this trajectory that's very laid out for us, but we don't know about children with developmental language disorder if their writing trajectory looks the same or has any differences, and that will really inform interventions that we design. And so next week I have my first participants lined up and I'm really excited to start that study.
Oh, that's great. I'm sure it'll be fantastic because I'm sure it'll bring yourself to it and it'll be, you know, thinking through all the different types of methodologies and shining a light on your participants and their experiences, and the interprofessional practice part will come out too. So that's so exciting. Congratulations and
thank you.
Good luck. The first is always the trickiest, right?
Yes.
So what is your favorite book from childhood or now? It doesn't have to just be childhood. I leave it open to both.
My favorite book from childhood was Goodnight Moon. I think that's probably a popular one, but whenever I think about my childhood in my library, Goodnight Moon was always a favorite that I remember reading with my mom.
Oh, so you have those warm memories around it too.
Yes.
It is a favorite, that's for sure. And now they have a lot of spinoffs. Yes. I don't know if you know this, but there's like Goodnight Ghoul, I think is like the Halloween spinoff.
I have Goodnight Scientist for the research. Yeah, that's what I was just there. Yep, it's very clever.
Recently, now I think Danica, you should write Goodnight SLP or something, you know.
Maybe. Oh.
Or Goodnight Educator. I mean, I'm surprised no one's written Goodnight Educator.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Right, like you're saying goodnight to your classroom. Like I could see that just taking off.
Good idea. Very good.
That needs to be done for sure. Yes. Well, Danica, thank you for a wonderful conversation. A lot of the topics we covered really address are related to partnerships. And I do want to do a shout out. We just launched the registration for our Implementation Science for All CSD collaborative, which is open to not just SLPs, but our partners and to educators. And Danica is a speaker at that conference. It's April 27th and 28th. It is virtual, and we really keep it at a good price point to make it accessible for all. And if you can't attend, then we have the presentations are available afterwards to view. So I just want to encourage you, I'll link it in the show notes along with your podcast, Danica, and all the resources we've discussed. So thank you so much, Kate, for joining me as a co-host, and Danica for joining us to share all the wonderful things you're doing with our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. And I attended that conference last year, and I think the energy that came from it was just so dynamic, and everyone was building relationships, building collaborations, and gaining so many great ideas to bring into their work in the clinic or in a research space. So highly encourage everyone to consider joining us next month for that. Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Check out www.seehearspeakpodcast.com for helpful resources associated with this podcast, including, for example, the podcast transcript, research articles, and speaker bios. You can also sign up for email alerts on the website or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or any other listening platform so you can be the first to hear about new episodes. Thank you for listening and good luck to you, making the world a better place by helping one child at a time.